and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Jordan Calhoun, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Megan Walbert, Lifehacker's managing editor.
And this week, we're talking about some tough parenting questions, specifically how to raise kids who aren't assholes.
Yeah, we really are. And we're going to try to answer the questions that seem unanswerable. And we're going to do that with science journalist Melinda Wenner Moyer.
Most parents are worried about their kids being bullied, but they never, ever think that their kids are going to bully. And there's really interesting research, too, that suggests that actually the parents of kids who bully are the least likely to think that their kids bully. So that's a real problem.
Melinda's an award-winning journalist who writes about science, parenting, and medicine. And she's a contributing editor at Scientific American, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and several other national outlets.
She's also a faculty member at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, and she just published her first book, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes, which is full of science-backed strategies for raising kids of all ages to hopefully not turn out to be assholes.
So my question here for you, Megan, our former parenting editor, is do you think parents know when their kids are assholes?
Kids are assholes a lot, is the problem.
Right?
And I think what's tough is you start off with them. Well, they're not assholes when they're babies, but by the time they're toddlers, they can be pretty asshole-ish. They get there real quick and they kind of keep it going. You know, it's like every different phase that they go through, you know, kids are great in lots of ways, but they can also be very self-centered, which is just a normal developmental thing. They can, you know, sort of play around with being disrespectful, pushing boundaries, then they're teenagers and they don't want anything to do with you. So yeah, it's kind of hard to see into the future sometimes and ask yourself, you know, what is normal?
What is part
of the learning process of becoming a person? And what is an indication that my kid is going to grow up to be an asshole?
Right.
It's a tough line.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Jordan, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this because, you know, as, you know, some of us at Lifehacker know, you have been thrust into the temporary parenting role of your teenage nephews. And it's kind of been a joy for me to see parenting through your fresh eyes. And so I'm wondering from you, like, what has surprised you about this experience?
Man, okay, so what surprised me, aside from the small parenting things about, you know, just how much time it takes to do their laundry and how much time it takes to feed them, when it comes to them in interpersonal relationships, how they treat each other, how I see them treating other kids while they're here at basketball camp, is how often they can teeter back and forth between being the sweetest, most respectful kids that I've ever seen and then suddenly being assholes and not realizing it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there's so many ways that they'll treat each other or ways that they'll treat their friends that I really don't think that they even realize that they're being jerks. And then the question that I have to ask myself, to your point, is like, how often do I intervene and sort of stop the scene right there and say like, oh, this isn't cool for X, Y, or Z reasons, or just let it go because they're, you know, young teenagers and they're just learning how to navigate relationships and people's reactions to these type of situations will naturally teach them on their own, right? Like, how much do I need to intervene on certain, teaching them certain basic consequences that'll happen if they say or do certain things versus me explaining that to them and trying to keep them from those scenarios.
See, that's the age old pick your battles, right?
Yeah.
It's just figuring out which battle to pick is the problematic part.
Yeah, yeah. And I think so far I've been leaning towards fighting a lot of those battles, which is exhausting.
I was going to say, it's just because you're not tired enough yet.
Yeah.
You'll get there.
I'm getting there pretty quick. It's been a few weeks and I already noticed myself like hearing certain things or seeing certain things and being like, all right, if it happens again, then I'll say something.
One more time, that's going to be it.
Exactly. Well, I think Melinda will be able to help us with all of this. So let's dive into that interview.
Absolutely.
Melinda, thanks for joining us on The Upgrade. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. So for context, I am not a parent, but I have two nephews who are 14 years old who are staying with me for the summer. So I have like temporary parenting experience Megan is a parent. I want to start with some broader context for the book. Great title, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes. What's an asshole? I feel like we need to operationalize that for listeners, right? So like, what's your definition of an asshole? And is that different for adults than children?
Yes, that's a really good question. So yeah, as I was conceiving of the book, I actually came up with the title before I like really thought about what was going to be in it. I tried to like list out what are the characteristics of assholes. And I was thinking like mainly of adults. So the title is, you know, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes, but it's really how to raise kids who don't grow up to be assholes, because I feel like kids are often assholes, and like they have to make mistakes in order to learn from them. They have to learn the cultural norms of what's polite. Like they don't know. So they're going to be assholes sometimes. So I made a list of like what I thought were the key aspects of assholery. And then in order to then like dig into the research to find what do we know about parenting approaches that shape these traits. And so the first one that came to mind was like selfishness was really like a big core part. Like, so then I looked into, you know, how do we raise kids who aren't selfish, who are generous and helpful? That seemed like a really core thing. Bullying, like bullying seems like an aspect of assholery for both adults and for kids. So I was looking into also like, what do we know about what shapes, what makes kids bully? I felt like laziness and whininess was kind of like a component too. And so I looked into like, how do we raise kids who are resilient and motivated and stuff? What else? Racism, sexism, those are another two really big ones where I was like, I want to know what the research says on raising kids who aren't racist, aren't sexist. So it's like kind of all over the place. I guess I don't have like a singular definition, but I saw it as like this umbrella term that comprised all of these specific characteristics that were bad.
Assholes are multifaceted people.
They are. There's a lot of things that can make somebody an asshole. Yeah.
You know, you started with selfishness, and I want to kind of dig into that a little bit because, you know, when I think of kids, I think of when they're really very little, toddler age, you know, they really do kind of think that the world revolves around them. I mean, that's really actually sort of their worldview. But then as they get a little older, you know, you think they're going to reach a point where, you know, they're developing more empathy. They're understanding that people other than them have feelings and experiences and memories of their own. But it doesn't seem like it happens as fast as it should. What are your thoughts on that? How do we get over that hump of teaching kids to be more selfless and be thinking more of others?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I totally agree that toddlers, preschoolers are so self-absorbed. And I think it's a developmental thing. Like it's just the way that they are, and they're, you know, there's not much we can do at that age. Although I do think there are things that you can do starting when kids really can just understand you that are going to help lay the groundwork to developing, you know, selflessness and generosity. And what was really interesting about digging into this research is that overwhelmingly, it seems one of the most important things we can be doing with kids is talking about feelings and like our own feelings, their feelings, acknowledging them, validating feelings. And at first I was like, why does, you know, what's the link here? Why is talking about feelings so important? But when you think about it, in order for a kid to be generous and thoughtful and selfless, they have to be able to understand another person's emotions. Like they have to be able to recognize like, oh, my friend is sad. And why might my friend be sad? And what can I do to help them? And so they have to be really like fluid in the language of emotions and in just like recognizing what they look like and what they mean. And when parents talk a lot about them, and you know, bring them up when they're reading books and things like that, it helps to solidify the development of this. And I guess the skill that like talking about feelings really helps to solidify is called theory of mind, which is essentially the ability to take other people's perspectives. And this is really strongly tied to how generous and helpful kids are. There was one like fascinating study that I cite in my book that I think just illustrates this in a really salient way. So researchers asked, I think it was like 3 and 4-year-olds into the lab with their mothers. A lot of research only has mothers. It's really annoying, but that's another topic.
That is annoying.
where are the dads? Okay. And they asked the moms to read their kids a book, and they recorded how frequently the mothers would pause the book to talk about the characters' feelings and just like engage with their kids about feelings while reading this book. And then, so they recorded that and they analyzed it and saw like, okay, these, you know, this parent was really talking about emotions and this parent wasn't. And then they took those kids individually into another room later and had them play with a researcher. And the researcher would feign needing help. Like she would like drop her pencil and be like, oh, I can't reach it. Or she'd be like, gosh, I'm so, so cold. And there'd be like a blanket across the room. And they found that the kids whose mothers talked about feelings when they were reading the books to them were much more likely to help the researchers later on when they needed help in this like contrived experiment later. And so that's just like a really fascinating illustration of this link. And you know, obviously the assumption is that the mothers who were reading these books in the lab and saying things about emotions, they do this a lot at home too. And so, yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, but there's a lot of research on this that links those two things.
I had a different question planned, but I sort of want to go on a tangent now that we started talking about research and the absence of fathers in this research. Can you tell us more about that? Can you sort of expand on what is missing in research about parent dynamics and raising their kids and how it affects them? And for those couples that are heterosexual male-female couples, is there a difference that mothers and fathers play in their role of raising kids who aren't assholes? Is there anything that research suggests about that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Well, so just with my looking through the research, reading through the research on parenting for the book, I noticed certainly that like almost all of the research that has been conducted before like the last 5 to 10 years, if it had, you know, caregivers coming in to the lab to do something, it was almost always all mothers or almost all mothers. And, you know, I think this reflects, you know, the culture of the times, like especially like the research that I looked at in the 80s and 90s. You know, I think the assumption was just that like mothers played the most important role in shaping kids' development, and they were around more, for they were able to come into the lab more because maybe they weren't working as much. But it was really striking because there's so few dads in this research, and it was really kind of disturbing to me. And because of that, I think we don't know as much as we should about the role that dads play in shaping kids' development. What I have seen in the research is that mothers and fathers sometimes do play like different roles for kids in the types of things that they emphasize with their kids. So I think fathers, from what I understand, they encourage kids to take more risks. They're more like they play with their kids more than mothers do. And I think also this kind of does reflect though the like emotional labor differences sometimes. Like mothers aren't as playful with their kids because they're like taking care of everything and they're doing everything.
They're mentally exhausted.
Exactly. Like who has time to play with their kids at the end of the day if you're doing literally like everything to keep them alive? So yeah. So it's hard to know like how much of this difference in playfulness is like a reflection of like the unequal burden on mothers versus fathers in a lot of families. But it is really interesting. And I guess this promotion of risk-taking can be really good for kids and is like a key way that like kids learn, you know, resilience and that it's good to take risks sometimes. It's good to try new things. And they get that sometimes from like their interactions with their fathers more than their mothers. But, you know, it's interesting because like, what are the implications then for families that do not have just like a heteronormative family that has a mother and a father? Like, and what's the difference in terms of like how the parenting might look and how it might affect kids if you have two moms or two dads? I don't think we know a lot about that. I don't think there's been enough research on that. I think it's a really important question.
You know, you're talking about the division of the role that a mother plays, the role that a father plays. And, you know, of course, we know that sexism and misogyny is still rampant in our culture. And I'm wondering, what are ways that we are sort of unconsciously promoting sexist ideas, and how can we avoid that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's actually my longest chapter in the book, but I'll try.
Yeah.
I'll try to
talk to us about it. I need to hear this.
Give us the highlights.
Okay, so to back up, it's really interesting because actually parents start doing things and our culture starts shaping our kids' development of sexism, like when they are born and before they're born, like when we have these gender reveal parties where everything's pink and everything's blue, like essentially. This is really interesting. You know, we emphasize gender more than we do kind of almost any other social category in our world, because every time we refer to people, like we don't describe their hair color or their eye color or their height or anything when we're talking about people, but we're almost always referring to their gender if we're using pronouns. And we're also, you know, treating boys and girls differently, like from the time they're born, where we're dressing girls in pink and having bows in their hair and boys in blue, and we're buying different kinds of toys for them. And then and there's different aisles in the toy store, and there's all these ways, like different sports teams, all these ways that we are basically like telling our children that boys and girls are very different. And so kids, they pick up on this. They're one of their like big jobs as little kids is to look around the world and figure out what social categories are important. And then they kind of try to figure out why. And so they are noticing from a very young age, like mom and dad talk about boys versus girls all the time. And you know, they see all these ways that we differentiate gender and separate people by gender. And they kind of interpret this as, okay, well, boys and girls must be really different then. Like, why else would we be talking about it and emphasizing it like all the time? And then they also pay attention to the kind of hierarchies and the differences in the way gender plays out in society. So like they notice that no women have ever been presidents. My daughter has like said some heartbreaking things to me about like the fact that she wishes she were a boy so she could be the president. And I'm like, oh my God. And this is like, she brings this stuff up even after I've told her like over and over again, girls can be president. They just haven't been president. That's another topic. anyway, but so they're seeing these hierarchies and they're making like interpretations of it. Like, gosh, maybe boys are smarter. Maybe boys are better. And the research on this is also like really, really heartbreaking to see because, okay, so I'll just describe one study that really stuck with me. Researchers invited 5, 6, and 7-year-olds, boys and girls, in to a lab and told them a story about a protagonist. They didn't say what gender the protagonist was, but it was a very, very smart person in this story. And then they asked the kids, so do you think this very, very smart person is a boy or a girl? You could probably see where this is going. But what was interesting, the 5-year-olds, so kids, when they're young, they have like in-group, out-group psychology is very prominent, where they really like people who are like them. And they really like, so girls love other girls and they think girls are the best and boys think, you know, boys are the best. So at around age 5, the girls will say, oh, the really smart protagonist is a girl. And the boys will say, oh, the really smart protagonist is a boy. But then you get to age 6 and 7 and it completely shifts. And the girls will say the really, really smart protagonist is a boy. And the boys always say it's boys. And so the research then is suggesting that around age 6 and 7, girls are looking at the world around them and making these interpretations and these conclusions that somehow, you know, boys are just better. They're smarter. That's why they have, you know, why they're in power more and why, you know, they make more money. Like they just see it playing out. So this is all to say that, you know, culture is sending these messages to our kids about gender all the time. But to the extent that we as parents can not emphasize gender as much as we often do, like not use, you know, not refer to boys and girls as much as like kids, like refer, you know, if you see a group of girls playing, you can try to call them kids as much as possible instead of girls. To the extent that you can like not buy stereotypical toys and encourage your kids to have like cross-gender friendships, that is potentially going to help. and yeah, it's like, to what degree, we don't know, because they're of course getting these messages from our culture
I mean, it feels like you're fighting against so much, yeah. You know, because that's so striking to me that from 5 to 6 is that there's such a strong line there, you know, from one side to the other. And it's like, how do you, you know, there is more, you know, gender neutral clothing out there and gender neutral toys, but it's like fighting against all the marketing and just the leadership structures that they're seeing, even within their own schools, you know, because a lot of times their kindergarten, first, second grade teachers are women and the principal is a man. So it's like, even, you know, within the classroom setting, you know, you're seeing this, even though nobody's really saying it or talking about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're getting those messages all the time. But I will say there is some research that suggests that kids can vary in terms of how strongly they believe in gender stereotypes. And the strength of those beliefs does affect things. So like, for instance, boys, the stronger they believe in gender stereotypes, like that boys should be tough and stoic and not cry. And, you know, the stronger they believe those, the more likely they are to, when they're like tweens and teens, to make sexual comments about girls, to grab girls' butts. So like when kids get older, these gender stereotypes become sexualized and then they, they start to encompass like the idea that boys, like, you know, they're tough but they're also smart, and that girls really exist for like sexual pleasure, essentially. Like, this starts to be the way that the gender stereotypes play out. And there is this like trajectory, though, of the stronger these boys believe in gender stereotypes when they're younger, the stronger they believe in them when they become sexualized, and then the more likely they are to sexually harass or sexually assault people. So, you know, you can make a difference as a parent in terms of pushing back against those stereotypes when you see them, trying not to emphasize the differences between the gender. So I was visiting my parents last week, and, you know, the generational differences are so big. At one point, my daughter, I can't remember what happened, but she started crying. And my dad was there, and he was standing next to my son. And he said to my son, "Well, we don't cry. We boys don't cry like that." And first of all, I was like, "Oh my God, my dad." And but what was so great is that my son, it was really funny because we were all there. My whole family was there. My son, my husband, and I, like, all at the same time were like, "That's not true." And my son was like, "I cry sometimes. It's fine." And, yeah, you know, I know.
Oh, that's great.
And my husband
that's
was great. Like, "No, it's totally okay." And so, like, we clearly are doing something that's good, in the sense that my son, like, knows that that kind of idea is outdated and wrong, and that it's okay to cry. So I do think we can push against these in ways that make a difference, you know, but it is hard because they're getting these messages from everyone, including their grandparents.
And you also mentioned cross-gender friendships is playing a role there. Can you talk about that a little bit more? How do cross-gender friendships early on in a child's life sort of help mold and push them in a direction that we might want them to go in?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there is research that's shown that, like, the more that girls hang out just with girls and the more that boys hang out just with boys, the more different they become and the more they start to believe in gender stereotypes. So you can imagine that, like, it's like this, like, kind of vicious cycle that kind of propagates when girls are only hanging out with girls, and they might think, like, "Oh, boys, like, they're gross and they're different." And then they might start to develop, you know, these interests that really, like, are just within the girls, and the boys have start to develop their own interests in games. And then they just become more and more separate from each other in terms of, like, what they do and what they talk about. And so because of this, like, the researchers who study the development of gender stereotypes and sexism say, like, to the extent that we can encourage our kids to be friends with kids of other genders, the more we kind of realize, like, we're not that different. Actually, we have a lot in common. Actually, you know, this kid is okay. Like, when I was a kid and I was growing up, I definitely had mostly girl friends, but I remember there was one boy who we had, like, an after school, my parents had an after school play date arrangement where he would come to my house some days and I would go to his house. And at first I was like, "I don't know how to play with this boy. Like, he's a boy and he plays with Transformers and I play with Barbies." But then, like, after just, you know, a couple of weeks of it, like, I realized, oh, Transformers are super fun. And, like, I would play and I would build forts with him. And like, I definitely feel like it kind of broke down these barriers that I'd had in my mind about, like, boys are so different and I don't like them. And suddenly I was like, oh, this boy's cool. Maybe some boys are cool. Maybe, you know. So yeah, the research does suggest that, like, this can make a difference too.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
That I really want to hit on that you've mentioned in passing a couple times is race and racism. You know, as we know, particularly in Black families, the race conversation is not only important, but a routine conversation that's being had within the family. A lot of times, I think in white families, it can be just sort of ignored completely. And we know now that that's not the way to handle it. So can you talk a little bit about why having those conversations, particularly within white families, is important? And then also, if we haven't been having those conversations, how do we get started on that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Yes. So you're right. White parents tend to avoid the topic of race. And I think for some parents, it comes from a good place. Like there's this idea that maybe if you don't talk about race, your kids won't see it and won't make a big deal out of it. And, you know, therefore your kids won't grow up to be racist. But the research really directly contradicts this. And again, it comes back to this idea that kids are looking around the world and trying to understand what matters. And they, like with the gender hierarchies, they see very salient racial hierarchies in power. And if they see this and they aren't told by their parents or teachers why this hierarchy exists and that it is because of racism and you know, the way that our society is built through policies and laws and whatnot, then they're going to make the simplest conclusion, which is, okay, well, maybe white people are just better, like smarter. So it's, again, these inferences that kids make, unless we really, as parents, push back against them, these inferences can be really dangerous. And the research has really, you know, illustrated this. We need more research on it, but there have been studies, and they've been actually really fascinating, because there's one study, Bridget Vitrep, who's a psychologist at Texas Woman's University, she had asked a bunch of white parents to come and come into her lab, and she asked them basically to go home and to talk to their kids about race for the next few weeks. And I think they were also watching TV shows about race too, but she said, please, like, we want you to engage with your kids about race. And 90% of the parents that she asked to do that didn't do it. They either, some of them dropped out immediately upon hearing what she was asking them to do. They were like, nah, I'm not going to talk to my kids about race. And the others like came
why
back.
I never.
It's nuts. And then the other ones just like came back and said like, no, I didn't actually have these conversations. I know you told me to, and I was going to, but I just didn't. But of the small percentage that actually did have the conversations, there was a control group as well of parents who weren't asked to do anything. And of the ones who had the conversations, those kids, when they were tested later, given like these tests for racial prejudice, those kids had less prejudice than the other kids whose parents hadn't had these conversations. So like there is evidence that these conversations do make kids less prejudiced, less racist.
And I wonder, is there a dividing line like we saw with boys and girls, and, you know, going from 5 to 6 and suddenly, you know, having your opinion shape, is there a sort of a line in the sand like that as well in terms of race?
Yeah. When do kids become sexist and when do they become racist?
I need to know. That's what we need to know.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. What I can tell you, I don't think I can answer this definitively. What I can tell you is that they have...
She's like 6.5. 6.5 is
the exact moment. You have to have those conversations before 6.5, right?
Before 6.5.
Oh my God. You know what? It is so much earlier than that, though, is the sad part. So,
oh no.
So like, okay. Researchers have actually shown pictures to babies, 3-month-old babies, shown pictures of people of different races to 3-month-old babies. And obviously, like, you can't like give them tests of racial prejudice when they're 3 months old, but you can discern based on, so babies will look at things that they like and that they want to engage with longer, you know, if they like them, basically. And they found that babies will look at pictures of faces that share their caregiver's skin color for a lot longer than they'll look at pictures of people who have different skin colors. So, you know, that doesn't really mean that babies are racist, but it means that they notice it, they see skin color, and that they, you know, they are changing their behavior a little bit based on it. But then researchers have also, like a lot of research from the 80s and 90s, and granted this was 80s and 90s and the world has changed a bit since then, but back then researchers would do these really long longitudinal studies where they would like go to a preschool every day for 6 months and qualitatively like write down what they're hearing kids say on the playground. And these are really disturbing because kids were constantly like saying racist things to other kids in their preschools. And this was, you know, they would say like, I'm not going to go on the swing with you because your skin is dark, or like, you know, your skin looks like rabbit poop was another one, like terrible things.
Wow.
And this was kids 2.5, 3 years old. And they were just, you know, these researchers were recording this like day in and day out. So like kids start to say stuff like this and act in racist ways when they're in preschool, essentially. So it's pretty, it's like pretty disturbing.
That's startling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which racist means, like, ass toddlers, man.
Yeah.
I mean, but.
And sometimes, and you know, what's a parent to do then? You know, if a lot of that's happening at school, you may not even be aware, but if you are made aware of it and you know, your 3-year-old is saying things like that to, you know, a little buddy at school, what do you do?
Yeah. So when I talk to researchers about this, they emphasize, like, first of all, you don't want to shame your kid immediately and like scream at them for saying something racist, because then they're like so upset and feel ashamed and can't really like listen to you beyond that point. So, and also they may not understand what they're saying, and they really may not get that what they've said is as terrible as it is. So they say, like, take a deep breath as a parent and say, like, oh gosh, where did you hear that? And what does that mean to you? Like, why did you say that? And try to sort of understand where they're coming from. And then beyond that, you know, say, okay, well, actually what you said is really hurtful, and let me explain why. And then you, depending on their age, you try to explain like why what they said is a bad word or is something that's really hurtful. And, you know, trying to explain like the impact of those words on another person. Like, that's one of the things I discovered just in general about discipline when I was looking at the research, is that it's really helpful to always like tie what your kid has done to how it affects other people. And that can be even just like when you're telling your kids to pick up the Legos, you can say, pick up the Legos because otherwise I'm going to step on one and it's really going to hurt me. And, you know, so like always kind of going one step ahead and thinking about how things affect others. And then you do want to engage with them and explain. I mean, it might be that you need to just start by explaining like why do skin colors differ? And what's, you know, the fact that different, you know, people have different amounts of melanin in their skin, and it really, and you know, it depends on who their parents are and their ancestors are and where they lived. And so giving them like this sort of simple explanation for skin color that isn't, you know, scary. Like, you know, kids sometimes think like people with different skin color have different blood and they're so different, and just explain like, no, it's just this one chemical in their skin. And then, you know, I think anytime you're seeing racist things play out, or somebody, you know, you see something on TV, like even if you see that like all the heroes in a TV show are white, you can bring these up with your kids and say, like, you know, start having conversations where when you notice skin color is relevant or salient, like you talk about it with your kids. But it's hard, because I think like for white parents who have been socialized to not talk about race their whole lives, it's really, really hard to suddenly like talk about it on purpose with your kids. It feels wrong. It feels like also you're going to make mistakes. And I know I've made mistakes and how I've framed things, but at the same time, it's much better to have the conversations, fumble through them, make some mistakes than to not have them at all.
Sounds like so much of this is rooted in just teaching empathy, which obviously easier said than done, but man. Okay. So we have to talk about bullying. There's so much to talk about, but we have to fit bullying into this. Okay, so thinking about when I was a kid and the conversations that I had about bullying with adults, it was always about how I would respond to bullies, like how to react to it, how to stand up to a bully, how to get yourself out of those situations. I think most parents probably don't recognize or don't ever like to think of their child as the bully. So can you describe what to look for or how to respond when you discover that your kid is bullying someone else?
Yeah. Yes, you're exactly right that most parents are worried about their kids being bullied, but they never, ever think that their kids are going to bully. And there's really interesting research, too, that suggests that actually the parents of kids who bully are the least likely to think that their kids bully. So,
Wow,
it's a mess, right? So, yeah. So that's a real problem. And I noticed that too, just like in so many parents, when we move to the topic of bullying, they shift it from like their kid, you know, the assumption is their kids will never bully, but they're always worried about their kids being bullied. So one of the things that I learned talking to researchers who study bullying, which was really interesting too, is that there is a like not small percentage of kids who bully who actually really don't understand that what they're doing is hurtful. Like, of course, there are the bullies who know exactly what they're doing and are, you know, being terrible on purpose. But there are a number of kids who will engage in bullying behaviors who just like don't get that it's hurtful. And so I think, again, like the more that we can talk to our kids about what bullying is, what it looks like, you know, the fact that like some kids I think will engage in like sort of a teasing that they think is funny and they don't get how it affects another person. And actually kids of parents who I know a lot of like kids whose parents are really like funny and kind of like have this like dry kind of caustic humor with their kids too. Those kids I've believe someone, a researcher told me, like, are often the ones who sometimes bully without realizing that they're bullying, because they, you know, they, it's like part of their lives. This like kind of humor.
Yeah, this is just how we banter. Yeah,
exactly. But they don't really recognize the effect that it can have. So I think to the degree that we can, we actually should have like conversations with our kids about what bullying looks like, and the fact that, you know, that making a joke sometimes can really be hurtful to other people. And I've had, you know, I've had this experience with my own kids. There was one time when the principal called me. I was on a reporting trip and the principal called, and I was like, oh no, what's going on? And he's like, so your son was calling another boy a name on the school bus. And of course I was just like mortified. And when I got home, you know, what researchers say too, again, is like, don't jump immediately into the shaming, because you really want to understand what happened and then like engage with them and get them to listen to you and have a conversation if you can. So I said, hey, I got a call from the principal, like what happened on the school bus? And at first my son was like, you know, he didn't want to tell me. He was like, I didn't do anything. And I was like, well, I think something happened. Like, you know, and I eventually got it out exactly what had happened and what he'd done. And he was like, but we were just being funny. Like we thought it was a joke. And so he really, I don't know. I mean, he may have been, I don't know the degree to which he fully believed what he was saying about it being a joke, but I had to really unpack it and say, well, here's why that hurts. And can you, you know, remember when you were at camp and somebody called you this name, and like, how did that feel? And he was like, yeah, that didn't feel very good. Well, this is just like that. And you calling this boy that name, like, it really made him feel really sad and it really hurt him. And so having, again, the conversation about how it affected the other person is really important. And then one other thing that I think is really interesting from the research is we have this idea that bullies, like, it's a black and white thing. Like, your kid is a bully or your kid is not a bully, but there's so much middle ground where like kids can be bullied one day and then bully somebody else the next day, or like just be on the sidelines, kind of like encouraging the bullying, but not actually, you know, overtly like participating in it. There's all sorts of like gray middle area that kids are involved in with bullying too. That again, just means like we need to be talking about like what is helpful and what is not helpful when you're in a bullying situation. And but it's
a lot. It's a lot.
It's hard.
Kids can be mean to each other. I mean, you know, oh, like gosh, you said, like, I feel like it's definitely not a black or white. You're either a bully or you're not, because the way that kids can interact with each other, you know, especially once they're in elementary school and they're out on recess. And, you know, I've seen it with my own son and his friends, where sometimes I'm like, do you guys even like each other? Like, you're just constantly picking at each other, you know? It's like, it's exhausting.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, and I guess the other thing too is like talking to kids about what's the best way they can help someone who's been bullied. Like, what's the best way to be a bystander? And that's really interesting too, because talking to bullying researchers, like, I had assumed they would say like, always tell a teacher, or, you know, stick up for the kid. But actually that's not really what they recommend, because A, it can be really hard to stick up for a kid who's being bullied in front of a bully. You might put your kid in danger. Like, it might not, it just might backfire. Right. I mean, yes, if they feel comfortable doing that, that's great. But like, a lot of kids just don't feel like they can, or they just, you know, they're scared. Telling teachers can be helpful, but also sometimes it's not. So researchers have like interviewed kids who've been bullied and said, what is like the most helpful thing for you when you've been bullied in terms of what other kids do? And they really overwhelmingly say, like, after the episode, if other kids can just like be my friend, like come up to me, sit with me at lunch, like play with me on the playground, and just like show your support for me separate from the incident, and like show that like you're there and you don't hate me too. That is like really, really powerful. So that's just something else to like keep in mind when you're having conversations with your kids about bullying, that like, just, you know, if they see a kid being bullied, like just being there for them after the fact can be really helpful.
So as we wrap up here, Melinda, there's so much that we haven't touched on. We haven't talked about self-esteem versus narcissism. We haven't talked about social media. People can read the book for all those details. I want to touch on the three main types of parenting that you mentioned in the book. So there's authoritarian, authoritative, and permissive. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And I mean, there's a fourth, like neglectful, but that's pretty, as you
no
can imagine,
thinks
that's
of
not
themselves
good.
As the, yeah. my parenting type is ideally neglect. Yeah. No one thinks of that.
So no, like, and they're not reading, yeah, they're not picking your book up
no,
and trying yeah to learn.
No, they're certainly not.
That might be less neglectful. So yeah, what are the differences in those parenting styles? And is there one that's the best?
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, there is one that is overwhelmingly linked with better outcomes in kids in like all different ways. I mean, kids will have higher self-esteem and be kinder and do better in school and be less likely to use drugs and alcohol. And that is authoritative parenting. I find these words are so difficult because they're so similar. So authoritative parenting is essentially being warm and responsive as a parent, but also absolutely setting boundaries and having like rules. So there's like a give and take sort of. These parents are more likely to explain why they're asking their kids to do something instead of just barking orders at them. And they're more likely to negotiate with their kids when their kids are like, but I don't feel that I have to, should have to clean my room right this second. Like there's a push and a pull, but they're much more likely to look engaged with their kids, and they treat their kids with respect. Like they treat their kids as if like, you know, their kids have valid opinions too, and that they should be listened to. And this is very different from authoritarian parenting, which is basically the parents. These are parents who are much more common, I think like 20 or 30 years ago, parents who really like thought like, we are the ones in charge. Kids don't have any say in anything. They tell their kids what to do. They punish them more quickly, and they're just less warm and less responsive. So these are just like the really strict, overbearing parents a lot of the time. And then permissive parents, I think permissive parenting has actually become a little more common recently, because I think there's a misunderstanding sometimes about like what positive parenting is. And I think there's this idea that like, you shouldn't ever, ever, ever have consequences for your kids, and you shouldn't really have boundaries for your kids because it's like bad for their self-esteem or something. So this is what permissive parents do. They don't set boundaries. They never really are in charge. Their kids are essentially in charge. And I know a few parents like this, where like, it'll be the end of a play date and they'll be there to pick up their kid. And instead of saying like, it's time to leave, we need to leave, they'll be like, are you ready to leave? Well, we don't have to leave till you're ready to leave. And like literally follow their kid's lead on everything. And there's never any consequences, ooh, never any like, yeah.
It could never be me.
No, I know. I could never do it.
Jordan would not be a permissive parent.
You have just so much patience. Like I can't even imagine. No. Yeah. But I do see that sometimes where I'm like, ooh, I think that you need to have a little more. But yes, those are the three types, but authoritative is really what's like very strongly linked with good outcomes. And I think a lot of parents are authoritative these days. But I just think it's like been shifting a little bit more towards the permissive end.
I think this should probably go without saying, but I want to try to make it clear if possible. People can choose which type of parent they want to be, right? It's not like people are just naturally like, my personality type leads me to this, and there's no inflexibility there. I imagine it's probably, some are probably easier than others and they come more naturally, but like this is a malleable thing, right?
Yes, it is. But it can take time and it can be harder for some parents than others. So there's been research on like parent trainings, which often there's these parent trainings that actually try to teach like what is authoritative parenting to parents. And they do help and they do move people in the right direction, but it can take time. And also, you know, it depends on like how exhausted the parent is and how much, you know, how much support they have. Like, because being an authoritative parent, sometimes you really like have to be in a good place to respond to your kid warmly when they're, you know, having a meltdown for the 80th time in the day. And I certainly find like, I have days where I'm a better parent and a worse parent. And so it is malleable, but it's not like you can just like flip a switch and suddenly become like the perfect authoritative parent either.
Well, it's all super interesting stuff. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us. This was great to talk about. Such a good topic.
Oh my gosh. Thank you
so much
for having me. This was super fun.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA.
Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now it's time for Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one little thing that's making a big difference in our lives. And I'm going to start with you, Melinda. What's your upgrade this week?
So I have been drinking less, and that's not really been like my choice at first, but my neurologist, I was having a lot of headaches, and my neurologist said, okay, why don't you cut out most of the alcohol? And I was like, I don't want to do that. And then I did. And it's been actually really amazing. I guess it's obvious, like you're going to feel better, but I sleep better. I feel better. I have more energy. And so it's been.
That is great.
Great. Glad to hear that. And Megan, what's your upgrade this week?
Mine is actually also drink related. I have this water bottle that I'm just absolutely in love with. And it's called, I think you pronounce it Takeya. I guess like I'm going to take you with me when I leave the house. I don't know. But it's an insulated stainless steel water bottle that it's advertised as that it can keep your water or whatever you're drinking cold for 24 hours. And it's supposed to do the same with hot, although I have not tested that theory. And I don't know that it keeps it cold for 24 hours, but I don't really need it to stay cold for that long. But I have noticed right. that I can leave it in the car when it's hot out for like a good couple hours. And I'll come back and the outside of it will be warm, but the inside is still nice and cool. And it's just, it's a miracle to me. I don't know.
Was it really expensive?
It was like $30, I think. It was a gift, so okay. It didn't cost me anything. Yeah. but yeah, I think I was looking up earlier. I think you can find them for like $20 or $30.
Gift idea.
It's a super, super upgrade. It has a little handle so you can carry it. It's great. I love it.
Nice.
Jordan, what about you? What's your upgrade?
My upgrade this week, I should preface by saying I'm not sure. I'm still sort of grappling with whether this is good and genuine thing to do or whether it sort of undermines the reason behind it. This will make sense in a second. But basically, my upgrade has been, we all have friends that we have, you know, that we talk to, let's say, once every 3 months or once every 6 months or once a year or friends from college or whatever, that we like to check in on. And sometimes a long period of time would go by where I wouldn't check in with certain friends that I wanted to maintain a relationship with and know what's going on in their lives. So me being the type of person that I am, I probably went to the potentially extreme measure of scheduling those check-ins on my calendar.
Good.
Is that good? Okay. All right. My concern here is that it becomes a task and not genuine. Like if I am checking in with someone every 6 months, like clockwork, because I know that I am wanting to do that, I don't know. A part of it sort of rubs me the wrong way, feeling like it's taking away some of the organic and genuine and nature of checking in with someone to see how they're doing and making it just another to-do list item. But it has been working with me being able to reach out to people, you know, in the time frame that I want to and not let so long go, especially during the pandemic. We've all had like stretches of time where I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't seen or spoken to this friend since pre-pandemic times. It's been helping me to just stay on track with that. So if you guys say it's good, then that alleviates some of my guilt about it.
You know, I think that you might actually be building a habit for yourself. So, you know, instead of, you might feel like it's super structured right now, but just the act of getting into the habit of checking in, you know, at a regular interval, I think that might help you build that habit. And that's positive.
That's a much better way to think about it. Okay. That makes me feel good about myself.
I agree.
Thank you. Everyone get yourself a friend like Megan who will enable you and strip away your guilt.
That's right.
Beautiful. Well, again, Melinda, thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely great. A pleasure to talk with you. And everyone can get this book and talk about all the, like, listen to all the things that we didn't get to talk about.
Thank you. It was so great to chat about all this.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review so others can find the show and enjoy it just as much as you do. You can also reach us by calling 347-687-8109 and leaving voicemail, or write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
Yep. You could also follow us on that Bird app at Lifehacker. You can find us on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. You can also find me on Twitter at Jordan M. Calhoun and Megan at Megan Walbert. That is with an H in the first name, but not a H in the last name.
Right? Confusing. Yeah.
So confusing. You can also sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find the show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade by going to lifehacker.com and searching for podcasts. See you next week.